break out your wireframes and heat up those Git repos. We're ready to tackle topics ranging from accessibility to front-end design, user experience, and beyond. You're listening to the Drunken UX Podcast with your hosts, Michael Feenan and Aaron Hill.
Jingle bells, Batman smells, Drunken UX laid an egg. It was called episode 105, and now it's the season finale. Yay! I'm your host, Michael Feenan. I can't sing or make up songs, especially on the fly. That's why I have a co-host.
You know, we rehearsed this like 5 times, Michael.
I know, and I still got the episode number wrong, so I'm pretty sure I just said 105 instead of 104. So, it's been a long time, ladies and gentlemen. It's been a long time, and the numbers, they blur together. Hey, thanks for joining us. You are listening to the Drunken UX Podcast. I am your host, Michael Feenan. This is episode 104. It is the season finale.
And I'm your other host, Aaron. How are you tonight, Michael?
I'm gonna edit in some vuvuzela sounds, like, yeah, something clapping. Hey, everybody. This evening's episode, season finale, we're going to be talking about our naughty and nice list. It's Christmas time. In fact, I think, what is it, like 4 days before Christmas when this is coming out? So 5 days before Christmas. So Consider this the Christmas present. Who are we giving coal to? Who's going to get nice, shiny presents? alternatively, it's going to be our what are we looking forward to? What are we dreading for 2021 in web tech? But I thought we're going to go through actually a bunch of things and just kind of rapid fire these things off and go through them for you and have some fun. And with that, be sure to go run by our sponsors over at Tela. Tela is a fantastic screen capture platform that lets you use your browser to capture anything that you're showing or demonstrating or trying to help people with or create documentation for. Add your camera, add your audio, do it, edit it real quick in the system, make a really cool, sexy little video out of it, and you can go sign up for a free account. Just go to tela.com/ducks. That's tela.com/DUX.
Indeed.
No, not indeed. That's a job platform. This is Tela.
No, the job platform is Aquant.
Aquant is who I work for. We are a job platform as well.
But who's on first?
I highly encourage. Hey, first nice list item, Aquant. If you are a web developer, web designer, programmer of any kind, marketer, copywriter, UX professional, packaging designer, we have jobs all across the country, all across the world. If you are in Australia or Japan or France or UK or Germany, we've got jobs all over the place. Go check us out. Go do your search. Many of those jobs are remote now, and we put those up front and center. Was that an advertisement? I said that very much like an advertisement.
You know, everybody gets one.
I think we've got about 600 or 700 job postings right now for all of that stuff. So it's like, hey, come check us out. That's early, though. We're not to the list yet. I'm a sippy boy this evening, and unfortunately, I've been sick, actually. I've had a touch of cold. It is a cold. I am negative by proxy. That is not my band's name. My wife came home sick the other day.
But hey, negative by proxy would be a pretty awesome band name.
Right? I said this the other day. I'm like, that's the band name right there. Mm-hmm. My wife came home with a cold just out of an abundance of caution. She made sure she went and got tested and everything. Mm-hmm. It was negative. It was fine. I, of course, don't leave my house. So when I started getting the sniffles, it's like, no, I just got her cold.
Right. And
I'm a little scruffy throated, little sinusy pressure, a little sneezy.
I had that a few weeks ago, so I probably gave it to you.
Yeah, it might have been your fault. The packets. Yeah.
UDP is a lot less regulation over the UDP packet.
Yeah. And God knows I could have gotten it at any time. Mm-hmm. I'm drinking a tea instead.
Oh, wow.
Just to soothe the throat. It's a spiced apple cider tea.
Oh, that sounds really
good. A little
honey,
a little cream. It's Teavana. I don't actually know anything about tea. Mm-hmm. It's just in my shelf, so I'm drinking it. comes in a really fancy little like packet and stuff. It's not like your 50-cent tea bags mm-hmm. from the grocery store. But yeah, it's good. It tastes like apple cider.
My favorite tea is called Bengal Spice. It's by Celestial Seasonings, I think. And it's like a mixture of like cloves and cinnamon and probably allspice, maybe some cardamom. It's really good. It's like a real like warm, but also like zesty kind of flavor to it. But that's not what I'm drinking tonight.
But you're being the real adult in the room tonight.
I'm having an adult beverage. I'm having the Glenmorangie La Santa again. It seemed appropriate for our season finale to finish off with a classic Ducks drink.
I was going to do the Royal Salute 21. Mm-hmm. I think I've had it before. It's the blue ceramic bottle. It's a 21 blend. It's real good. And I was going to do my special. So instead, I might have to kick off season 5 with it. So
yes,
stay and tuned drink to tea. See.
So I'll drink tea on the next one. You can drink the scotch.
And I'll drink the scotch. Yeah. Can we put scotch in the tea?
Yeah, sure.
Whiskey and tea is a thing. Hot toddy? Isn't that what that is?
Do you want to put scotch in the tea, though?
Like, I have whiskey.
Yeah.
Some Four Roses?
I like putting Fireball. Ever since you turned me on to the gingerbread cocktail that you told me about, like, back in season 1, Fireball has been my choice cinnamon whiskey. And it is really good in cider.
Yeah. It is, but also I hate Fireball because it's so sugary. Mm. If you are interested in something in the same vein that is less sugary, less cloying, though it is still a little sugary, Oil Fire.
Okay.
Oil Fire. It's made by a distiller, I think, out of Tulsa, Oklahoma, and it is a cinnamon whiskey, but it's like much... It's much more whiskey forward. It's an actual rye whiskey. Mm-hmm. Fireball is not whiskey. Let's be very clear. Fireball is grain alcohol that has sugar and syrup and cinnamon flavoring added to it. but Oil Fire is actual rye whiskey.
Okay.
That they like blend in like, and I don't know what their process is, like if it's artificial, real, how they do it, but it's like a pecan and cinnamon kind of flavor to it.
All right, that sounds great.
It's very good. I enjoy it. I have been known to take a shot of it, even like a real boy. And it's like 35% alcohol, so like it's clearly watered down in that vein, but.
Something to try
if you're interested in that area.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's see. So I am Santa Claus in training. I've done. I didn't this year because of the COVID stuff, but I have been known to do youth leadership at the middle school for sixth graders.
Oh, cool.
And I always this time of year I go in and I explain to the little boys and girls of the community that I'm growing this giant beard with the great big white skunk stripes because I am Santa Claus in training, and so they better be good, because otherwise I will bring them lumps of coal, and they do not believe me.
I saw a webcomic recently where it was like a little kid getting a lump of coal on Christmas Day, and then the kid's like, yeah, and then they put it on a shelf along with other minerals.
Okay, that's funny.
Yeah.
I said we're gonna do naughty and nice list. So this is a little bit of mix. Naughty, nice. Looking forward to dreading. It'll mix it up. The first one I'm gonna throw out is an obvious one, and disrupted many of our lives. Though it isn't necessarily as web developer centric,
right?
But you probably heard about it, whether on Twitter, the evening news. It made the rounds very quickly. Mr. Log4Shell is going to get a lump of coal from me.
Yeah, that thankfully didn't. I don't think that hurt us at work at my job, or like it was a quick fix. If it was like we patched it quickly. But I know a bunch of people who
Ruby, I'm sure, uses something else, right?
Well, we're using Ruby, but you know, we have like an enterprise stack, so we have stuff upstream from us that I think may have been using it.
That, yeah.
Yeah.
You're not 100% Ruby. So, and I say that because Log4j, which is the library,
right,
is a Java package. So generally, you see it involved in Java applications.
Mm-hmm.
We use a content management system that is written in, guess, Java. So you can imagine, yes, we had a little bit of a hustle a few days ago to make sure things were safe and sound.
Mm-hmm.
And not just with that, like our entire like internal software development team is all Java, like our platform's Java, yeah, everything. So like there was a lot that went on behind the scenes. Luckily, wasn't something that I had to get my hands too dirty with. Mm-hmm. I was very fortunate, but certainly folks around me were very active with it and needed, you know, access to information and answers to questions that only we could give in that case.
It sounds like, from what I've read about it, the severity of it was severe, like it allowed, mm-hmm, remote code execution, but that the patch, or like the patching process, was actually maybe not painless, but certainly not nearly as bad as some other vulnerabilities that have come out in the past few years.
It wasn't bad. We were able to, you know, fix it without like software patches, mm-hmm, to the platform. We were able to do it like at the runtime commands,
mm-hmm,
and deal with that. So let's just, to kind of give people the 50,000 foot view, Log4j is a logging tool, if you, mm-hmm, can't tell from the name. What the thing about a logging tool is, a logging tool has system access, file system access. It can write code, or not code, but it can write stuff.
It can write files, yeah.
Yeah, it can write files to your system, which means if there is a way to get something into it,
mm-hmm,
you can conceivably write something bad to a server. And in the worst case scenario, you can not just write something bad, but you can also tell it to run something bad. Mm-hmm. One of the things, I mentioned this on Twitter, the thing that I find ironic about this is, yes, people were immediately trying to exploit it for things like ransomware,
mm-hmm,
and whatnot, trying to get access. Because, of course, anytime you get something like that, immediately you're worried about people getting access to, like, customer databases, sensitive information, anything like that. Because if you can read and write files to a server and run any kind of commands,
mm-hmm,
you conceivably have full access to that system at that point, or something close to it, depending on how, you know, what privileges are running.
As the kids say, own the box.
Own the box. no, it's hack the Gibson. Thank you. Yes. Almost got whiskey out his nose. Almost got it. The thing that makes this interesting to me, though, is the prevalence with which people are now using exploits like this to try to install crypto mining. Because the thing is, ransomware isn't necessarily as effective as knowing that, hey, we're going to go own 2 million boxes, right, that we may be able to get, I don't know, 30 million clock hours, mm-hmm, CPU cycles out of before people get it all patched.
Yeah.
And we're going to put that all towards crypto mining and get guaranteed money out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And once they patch it, oh well, we've already made our money and left.
Right, yeah.
So that's going to be something interesting, I think, to watch in the future. Yeah, because it's ugly. It's, you know, it's easy to catch, at least. Mm-hmm. That's the one thing. Like, you're going to see that CPU pegged and know something bad happened. But, like, it doesn't – this is an issue of scale, you know. Yeah. You can go buy the exploit, run it through a botnet, get it on as many machines as humanly possible, as quickly as possible, and then it's just about, yeah, make the money, as opposed to trying to handle a bunch of ransomware,
mm-hmm,
that most people won't respond to.
I don't know the exact number on it, but I imagine that the scale of impact is comparable to if WordPress had another Tim Thumb thing happen.
That's, yeah, I said the exact same thing in one of our meetings, that it's like, while the absolute like concept of the exploit is certainly very different,
mm-hmm,
the spirit of it is very much the same. Tim Thumb was a decade ago now.
Only a decade? I thought it was longer.
No, it was 2011, I think, was when that was. And so what it was is, there was a image resizing plugin called Tim Thumb, mm-hmm, that used or was it called Tim Thumb, or it used a package called Tim Thumb? I forget now.
It was timthumb.php.
Right.
And it was the issue was that it was patched like shortly after the exploit was found. The problem was that it was used by so many themes.
Right.
And these themes didn't use the newer version, or they didn't know to.
Yeah, you had to patch through your themes. Yeah. You didn't just see the plugin in your backend, for instance. And because it resized images, so the same thing holds true, right? Mm-hmm. A Log4j writes log files to a system. Tim Thumb wrote resized images to a file system.
Mm-hmm.
And this vulnerability allowed you to write just raw PHP files and run them on a system.
I actually had two WordPress instances get owned by Tim Thumb, and that sucked. That's like I learned how to reverse engineer it and everything, but man, it was not a fun time.
And you go back say 10 years, right? Mm-hmm. And that far back, WordPress was only running something like 15% of the web, 13% of the web. But that was still as far as surface area goes, it was still one of the largest used CMSs. Mm-hmm. And like you said, so many of those themes use that. It created this huge surface area for attack. And Log4j is an Apache product that everybody trusts and uses in basically any kind of Java application, mm-hmm. because nobody wants to go roll their own logging tool. It doesn't make sense to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So they're picking up the package, dropping it in, and boom. So, yes. Lump of coal goes out to Log4Shell. Hopefully we don't see this again.
Log4Shell is the name of the exploit?
Yeah, Log4Shell is the name of the exploit. It's like it's CVE 2021 number. I forget what the exact number is now. But you can go read about it. Just Log4j exploit. Log4j CVE, and you'll get plenty of information.
Look on the news. Actually, by the time this airs, it might be out of the news. But yeah, it shouldn't be hard to find info on it.
Okay.
I want to give a shiny present. Or what's the opposite of coal? Is it presents?
Good. Yeah. See, you've got somebody on your nice list. Who's on your nice list?
Today, or maybe it was yesterday, Rails version 7 was officially released. I played with it a little bit during the release candidate, and it was nice. Like I like some of the improvements they made to it, specifically on how they handle assets like CSS and JavaScript. That was really cool. I'll get back to that in a second. I tried upgrading an app to it, and it ran into some issues with one of my libraries that I was using, so I had to back down to 6. But I brought over a gem that they're using in 7 called CSS Bundling Rails, and man, it's so much fun. I've been getting to do a bunch of writing a bunch of SAS and everything, and there's nothing revolutionary here as far as like what it does, but it packages all the assets in a way that you just reference the font or the image or the CSS file or whatever by name only. You don't have to give a path or anything, and it just finds it. And it was so easy to use that when I initially used it, it wasn't working right because I was trying to overcomplicate it, and I didn't realize that it was just do all this by magic. So that was a lot of fun. And in the process of this, I've gotten to learn, gotten to practice a lot of like CSS transitions and animations and a lot of like CSS 2 and CSS 3 stuff. That was really cool. So,
and Rails 7 now too, that it's much more like module bundler friendly for JavaScript, right? Like,
yeah,
it's not like really embracing Webpack. I use Rollup for quite a bit of stuff.
Yes,
I've used Parcel in the past, and now you can kind of bring.
Yeah, you can do like the complement to CSS bundling Rails is JS bundling Rails, and so when you load these gems up, for CSS, you tell it, do you want to use SAS? Do you want to use Dart? Do you want to use Bootstrap or Tailwind? That's kind of the default. I tried Tailwind, wasn't a huge fan. I like just doing regular SAS. That's just me. No disrespect to Tailwind, just not my thing. And then the JS one, you pick if you want like Webpack, or I think Rollup was one of the options. There might have been a couple other options. I don't remember them, but you you just pick which one you want, and then it uses that. You can continue to use Webpacker as they've done in 5 and 6, or you can switch to one of the new things. But the whole point was to get kind of decouple it from the JS like world, because it there's a lot of pain, a lot of pain trying to get an app spun up when you have to deal with like JavaScript assets and stuff. Just because like the JS community, the way that they like manage all of their like plugins and libraries and everything is a lot more like distributed, and there's a lot of like move fast, break stuff attitude there. And it's different than how the Ruby community maintains gems, which is a kind of at a different cadence. So running into like a lot of mismatch there, kind of annoying. But yeah, so it's, I guess my present goes to selfishly to Rails 7/CSS Bundling Rails for giving me an opportunity to get to do SAS and stuff again. That was fun.
Making everything old new again.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, that's good. I've got one. I'll put somebody on my, I'm going to say nice list. And everybody else can argue with me on this, but this one's going on my nice list, not my naughty list.
Okay.
And that's GA4 for 2021.
Okay. So what is GA4?
GA4 is Google Analytics 4.
There was a 3?
There was a 3, technically. Universal Analytics was GA3.
What was 2?
2 would have been like the original, not Universal Analytics, but whatever they were calling it right before that. This would have been like post-Urchin acquisition. Like the basically V1 of Google's actual ownership. Because prior to that, if you look at any old code, you might notice like references to like Urchin Tracker and things like that. And that's what it was before that. And so that's sort of like the version 1.
Okay, so Urchin was version 1. And then Google Analytics proper by name was 2.
2.
And then 3 was...
UA was 3. And now we have GA4.
Okay, so I missed 3.
And my apologies to anybody if I did get that wrong and there was an exploit in there, but I'm working from memory on that, and that's a lot of years of change to accommodate. But no, I'm excited about it. I've been digging into it, learning my stuff on it. I do plan on getting some folks on the show to talk about it next season, to really kind of explain the ins and outs of it. Because the thing is, and the reason why I'm like, I'm putting it on my nice list, because I've been using it. I've been experimenting with the power. They've done some things. They've brought some functionality from things like Data Studio and just built it into GA4 so you can build really complex dynamic reports just right in the product. It's super cool. It's also a completely breaking change. Like, there is no migration from Universal Analytics to GA4.
Oh,
you start from scratch. It's a new interface. It's new terminology. It's new everything. And I've seen more than once already people go into GA4 and be like, the hell is this? And just peace out. Because it's like, it is not what they are used to seeing. And it is, they can't get the information they want. And like, everything's an event now. Events are a special thing in Universal Analytics. Like, you define events. You tell it exactly what you want an event to be and how they're categorized and labeled and all of this stuff. That's gone. Like, everything, a page view is an event. A click is an event. But then you can add your own events into it. And there's a bunch of like system-supported like default events, and then you can just make up your own. and it's a very new way of thinking about it, but it's so super powerful. So, like I say, I'm going to let people fall on that topic where they want to, really. But I'm really excited about it. I'm excited to share with folks next season, you know, how this can be really powerful moving forward, and how it's going to make a lot of things easier, too. The process of tracking like custom stuff in Universal Analytics is a little cumbersome. It requires, if you're using Tag Manager, you know, a lot of custom tagging or building stuff into your own JavaScript to pass through data layer variables and things like that. Not anymore. I mean, you still need a little bit of that, but now you need less of all of that. And it's going to be real cool. Gone are the days of goal funnels, building goal funnels by hand in Universal Analytics. Now you're just making conversions, and then you visualize how people get to those conversions. It'll be cool. But it is a breaking change. It's going to take a lot of learning. And so that's why I'm saying, like, this is for my 2021 list, because I still have a lot to learn. We have not fully deployed it anywhere within our company yet. You want to go next, or you want me to throw another one out there?
All right. I don't want to go into this deeply tonight, because I feel like we probably talk about this in season 5. But I'm throwing some coal at Web3. And it's going to be petty, spiteful coal.
Literal coal?
Yeah. Oh, no, because they'll just burn it to run their crypto miners.
They're already buying up power plants in Pennsylvania.
They're recommissioning
coal-fired power plants.
We had that happen in Watkins Glen, like west of here, not far from here, but at the next lake over. A company bought a power plant over there for that purpose. I think the shortest reason I can give here is, I think the reason I dislike it is, like, we're finding new ways to introduce artificial scarcity into an environment of abundance. And secondly, I mean, the environmental costs, whatever. Like, I accept that, like, some companies may be able to use solar panels or wind energy or whatever to power the crypto mines. My argument to that would be, okay, well, if that power can be generated, we still have a lot of fossil fuel power powering our grid. Why are we not putting it towards that first? But mainly, though, it's just this idea. Like, imagine, I guess one of the nightmare scenarios I'm imagining is you get an MP3 or whatever music file we're using in the future, and you want to play it, but you can't play it unless you own a token saying that you own it. And that's great for, like, the labels, and maybe for, like, I guess in a way, maybe for the artists. But, like, we have memes, we have all kinds of remixes. And I don't just mean, like, music, I mean just everything. Remix culture in general. Like, if you look up, I think Lawrence Wessig wrote about that, right? The remix culture? Cory Doctorow. That's what I'm thinking of, I think.
Okay. I was going to say, I did a talk years ago called Remixology that was based on some of Lessig's works on, the book with the black and white stripes.
Yeah. It was one of
free
them.
Free culture.
That was it. I have that book. Yeah. So, these things, like internet memes, all this stuff, it's all because the internet is a free and open place, and we have ways already to monetize stuff. We have ways already to sell things that are produced. And if it's not being done correctly, I don't know that this is solving that problem. I saw a thing today where someone was complaining that when they got onto Twitter years ago, like near Twitter's inception, they ran home and registered, basically name squatted, like 1,200 different names. They're going for, like, generic names, basically like people do with domain names. They'd get, like, shoes and cars and stuff, and then they'd get brands, and then Twitter took them away because they were, you know, squatting. And they were like, oh, well, with Web3, this would never happen. And, like, I don't think that that's a bad thing that the names are taken away. And then the whole thing with, like, the metaverse, and, like, if things move on to the metaverse, like, if that's where everything moves to, I will die in the woods. Like, I don't want to. I'm middle-aged, and maybe I just sound old, but, man, all I can see with this, and this is maybe cynicism here, but all I can see with this is ways to, like, reintroduce, like, classist problems into a space where we don't need to have them. And it's going to screw over normal people and make some very few people a lot richer. And I think that's where I want to end that. I'm sorry that went longer than I wanted to, but go ahead.
No, because I'm going to throw a couple things on that. So I think, for one, I'm with you in terms of, I think Web3 gets to be on my naughty list for 2021. I think partly, though, because it's not time to talk about it yet, really. And we will. I do want to talk about it next year, because I want to be thinking ahead, at least, right. on and you know, helping people understand what they should be keeping their eyes out for. But we are still probably 2 to 3 years out from a real meaningful implementation of Web3 technology, mm-hmm. like truly meaningful. Ethereum name service is out there. You can go register a .eth name already. Costs you $5 and then another $90 to $300 in gas fees. Like, you know, you talk about like Classist, right? Anybody can go buy a $12 domain right now. Mm-hmm. Granted, yeah, you probably aren't going to get exactly the name you want, but it's still $12. Mm-hmm. Until gas fees come down, which if you don't know, gas fees are like a, call it a process, a transaction fee that mm-hmm. basically applies to the transaction. Then people who can take advantage of things like the Ethereum namespace are going to be limited. Because mm-hmm. not everybody can drop $300 on that transaction.
Yeah,
That's expensive. That makes that out of reach. I was looking into it because I'm one of those folks like I'll often go on things and like secure my name, so sure. to speak. I have a unique name. I like to make sure I have it where I've got it. And I thought, you know what? I'm just going to register it and set it aside. And I went in there and it was like, oh, cool, $5 and $321.98 mm-hmm. in gas fees. And I was like, I'm sorry, what?
Bingo.
Like, screw that.
I think a lot about this, about like, I know about it. I have awareness of it and I can sort of see how it would be used in the future. And I don't know if I want to, like, I don't know if I want to participate. I don't know if that's something that I want to get on board with.
I've mentioned before, episode or two back about this when it just kind of came up in passing. And I said, you know, one of the things I do see like potential for in the future is sort of a trustable authentication model
mm-hmm.
that lets you take yourself from site to site without needing an account everywhere. And it is secure and
that, yeah,
you know, and not shareable and all of that, not stealable, basically.
That is the use case that I could actually see something like this being useful for.
That would be big.
But man, we need to bone up the security seriously, because like people are already getting NFTs stolen and other things. And I don't sure, just mean yeah. by right clicking and saving, because people don't understand what NFTs actually are. I mean, like, literally the wallets are getting stolen because the cards yeah. are getting taken.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you can always steal a set of credentials, especially if they're mm-hmm. saved on paper, which, you know, cold storage is a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing though, that I'll just kind of throw out there as a caveat, artificial scarcity does not inherently have to be built into it.
Right.
You know, like, you can build a site, like you could build a Web3 version of Facebook that's designed to, you know, store all of your posts and everything, and it can just grow and grow and grow.
Mm-hmm.
But what it does do is get back to this notion of how do you pay for it? How do you, you know, how do you cover all of that processing time on mm-hmm. those blockchains? Right. And all of that. Like, if everything's a blockchain, like, those blockchains can grow ad infinitum.
Yeah.
So there is a processing overhead. And for lots of small sites, that will never be a problem. But for huge sites, it could be a big problem. But ultimately, what we need is the first real, like, real-world proof-of-concept sites mm-hmm. that are going to run this way. Like, true mainstream sites. And then we'll see.
I think that, like, I mean, I think the other thing that would have to happen too is have some kind of regulation around it by some kind, and I'm not saying the US government, but some kind of governing body to provide oversight and regulation on this. There was a thing that happened last week, where the fellow was selling something for, like, I want to say 75 Ethereum, which was a lot of money, but typed it in wrong and sold it for 0.75 Ethereum, and then a bot snatched it up and paid $8,000 in gas fees to have it processed very quickly, and then immediately turned it over and sold it for like 20 times what they paid, or some crap like that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of room here for exploitation, and
yep.
My concerns are there's not enough prudence here. And it feels a lot like I'm feeling similar to how I feel about a lot of stuff that I see with the JavaScript community, which is, you know, the moving fast and breaking stuff, but not considering the longevity or the maintainability of what they're proposing. And so
it's okay to move fast and break stuff when the stuff is not of consequence.
Right, right. Like,
but you if what you're breaking is of serious consequence, you need an undo button.
Yeah, it's one thing to spin up a like a React site, and then all of a sudden you've got 500 React components, and it's like, what did we do? I'm really trying to not be a Luddite about it, but I am just concerned about, like, everyone has dollar signs in their eyes, and people aren't thinking about safety, and especially about, like, everyone. You know, it's just, what can this do for me? And, like, that bothers me. So, big fat lump of coal, yeeted.
The coal.
But not burnable coal. Just, like, synthetic coal. It just looks like coal and has the same weight. It's just a rock. I'm throwing a rock at Web3.
A black rock.
A black rock.
Obsidian.
Yeah. It's glass. A big chunk of obsidian. It's already been burnt. You can't burn it for energy.
Nice list.
Give us something good.
Let me give you a nice list item.
Yeah.
Vanilla JS. I'm making the call now, making my prediction. I think 2021 is going to be the year that Vanilla JS really is the way of the future. I think at this point, most people are really starting to buy in on, you know, the importance of understanding how vanilla JavaScript works.
Mm-hmm.
For those who don't know, like, I'm not saying Vanilla JS as like a framework. Vanilla JS is not a framework. It is literally just writing plain JavaScript, yeah, not using things like jQuery. The reason I'm making this call now is jQuery usage across the internet, across like the top 100,000 sites, over 80% of them use jQuery.
Mm-hmm.
That number is, for virtually the first time, making a downward trend, like an actual measurable downward trend. It was not much this year, but it was enough that I think we have actually seen the curve, and it's all downhill from here. And so we're going to start seeing the death of things like jQuery. And I will celebrate, I will dance, and I will give it a very nice present for going away.
I think that jQuery deserves whatever is the equivalent of like a an honored burial. jQuery may not be the thing anymore, but holy shit, that thing powered the internet at large for many years.
Yeah, I don't say that to mean like, yeah, man, jQuery, that nasty little troll. Mm. No, it's just time to move on.
Yeah, like I would agree with that. And I also agree with you on the Vanilla JS. And just for reference, we talked about Vanilla JS on episode 71 with Christopher DeNandi,
yeah,
who is a really awesome person. Thank you so much for being on the show. Was that this year? No, that was last year, September last year.
I literally don't remember
now. I just looked it up. I agree with you. I think that things are going that direction. I think that I mentioned Rails 7 earlier. A big thing in the new version of Rails is their Hotwire component, which is, do you remember when we used to use Ajax to load partials of sites?
Sure.
Like, you know, you go to, so you click on a navigation and then it just retrieves the content that gets swapped in place. Okay. More or less, that's what Hotwire is. Like HTML over the wire. It's pre-rendered and then just swaps it into place.
Right.
So it's a lot faster. Because you're not loading the whole page anymore. There's no page refresh. It's just, you know, a couple kilobytes of data splattered into place. Fits well with Vanilla JS. It's basically library independent because you're just using, you know, protocols instead of, well, not protocols, but you're using like, what's the word I'm looking for? What would Ajax be called? A technique or
an API?
Is it an API?
I mean, because you're not like, we don't do like a dot Ajax anymore. We do a fetch, and
yeah.
A fetch is an HTTP request that happens over the wire to an API.
Is fetch the vanilla? Because it used to be XML HTTP request.
Yeah, right. We don't have to do any of that anymore.
Oh, okay.
That's why I'm so big on vanilla.
I've been deep on back end for so long.
That's cool. Where jQuery served its purpose.
Yeah.
jQuery gave us the dot Ajax request method that unified all of those XML HTTP request objects,
mm-hmm,
and different for Internet Explorer versus Firefox and all of that. Like, it normalized it all down to one command, and then you didn't have to worry about it. That, mm-hmm, was great. Now we just have the Fetch API.
Yeah.
Like,
that's awesome.
That's all we need. So I'm calling it the year of vanilla JS. jQuery is going to be on a downward trajectory from here on out. It hasn't, mm-hmm. we have nothing left to learn from jQuery. And it was nice while you lasted. You had a real damn good run. I mean, what, 20
yeah,
years?
Yeah, legit. For the, legit, basically. Thank you. I mean, to all the people that maintained it, like, thank you, because I think that a lot of what we're where we're at today is because of what jQuery did for us.
Yeah. From there, I'm going to throw out a lump of coal. This one goes out to all of the web accessibility lawsuit trolls that are coming out of the woodwork.
More?
We saw like a 25% increase last year, right?
These are, wait, just to clarify, you're not talking about overlay stuff. You're talking about when people sue
websites. I'm talking about lawsuit trolls.
Yeah, like they're suing a site for not being accessible, but they don't right. actually care if they're accessible or not. They're just right. trying to take money. Okay.
They are abusing the legal system in hopes of getting some quick paydays, the same way people have abused DMCA and content law to just blanket shoot out, you know, lawsuits in hopes of settlements and to get money, not because they want to change the web for the better. Right. Because it's twofold. So it doesn't improve anything by doing mm-hmm. that. And it's also not teaching the lesson of why it's important to make things better. Right. In 2018, there were about 2,300 cases. In 2019, it was 2,890. Last year was 3,550. That's a 50% increase over 2 years. And over at digitalcommerce360.com, they are crunching the numbers and are expecting the number to break well over 4,000 by the time Jesus. This year's up. Which would be up another 20%, basically, from last year. So that's, you know, 20 to 25% a year growth. And I'm concerned that 2022 is going to be more than that. Yeah. And this is just a prediction. This is not necessarily based on anything except intuition. Mm-hmm. I'm just concerned that it is too easy to file these cases, and there's too much opportunity to try and throw them around and get a quick payday out of it and not teach anybody anything. And that sucks.
And worse, under the veil of, like, trying to do something good. But, like, this makes me mad.
Yeah, like, this is, like, all the wrong reason. Yeah, this is an earned lump of coal for those folks. This is not the way we make the web better. It's just... Until we have like some good frameworks and good guidelines, mm-hmm. It's to this day we're still confused about whether or not like Section 508, like what does it cover? Does it only cover governmental websites, or does it apply to anybody with a public presence? You know, mm-hmm. can they make claims under Title III? Does a web presence count as that, or right. can a company just say, well, if you need something, you have to call us?
Right.
We don't have to make our tool accessible. Like we have an accommodation. It's called the phone. Call us. Like, I mean, that's a legit. Lot of people's answers.
Yeah.
They say, yeah, no, we've made an accommodation. You can't use our website. We don't have the resources, because we're not talking about places like Target and Domino's. I'm talking about Bill's Car Repair down the street, right. who has a 3-page website that's basically brochureware. And they have like a form on it to schedule an appointment, right. and that form's inaccessible. And he's just like, "I fix cars, man. I don't know how to fix the form, and I'm not going to shell out $10,000 to somebody to do it. If you need something, call me." Like,
right?
He's not wrong. Like, you know, that's like, and there's
is it better for Bill's Car Garage to not have a website at all than to have it be a website that is inaccessible only because he doesn't have the resources to make it accessible?
So here's the thing. Okay, so I'm going to actually roll this in with a shiny present. Different topic, different subject. But there's an underlying message here that I think is worth sharing, so I'm just going to kind of roll from one to the other. This present goes out to Dr. Jennifer King. She's a privacy and data policy fellow over at Stanford University. The reason I'm calling like her out as a person for a present in 2021 for the web is she has taken over the darkpatternstipline.org.
Ooh, okay, say more of this.
So yeah, so this is a website. It's literally darkpatternstipline.org. Okay. And what she's doing is this is a site that was taken over from, I believe, the Consumer Reports Digital Lab. And they have taken it over through a grant and some other stuff. And you can go there and you can literally report finding a dark pattern in the wild.
Okay.
And then they have a gallery that is broken down by things like, how did this harm you? Did it deny you choice? Was it experienced discrimination? Did you feel shamed or tricked? Did you lose money or privacy, or did you waste time? Like, and you can go through here and see all of these examples, where it happened, you know, the person's description of it. Think of it, it's not quite like the BBB for dark patterns, but it's like that. So the reason, though, I'm rolling this in, there's an interview over at futurity.org that you can read, and I'll have it linked in the show notes. And there's, in this interview, the question is asked about, like, how do you distinguish between harmful dark patterns and something more innocuous, right? Just because something is bad doesn't mean it had bad motivation or, you know, bad emotion behind it. So Bill's car service didn't build something inaccessible with the motivation of causing people harm.
Right.
Like, and if he could fix it, he would fix it.
Right.
But he can't. And we have to, and this is where, like, concepts of, like, regulation and punishment, I was talking with somebody earlier, and they asked, man, is there any way to, like, you know, take the ruler to the knuckles on people who do this kind of stuff? And I'm like, how? Because how do you distinguish this in a way that doesn't disproportionately cause more harm to people that aren't acting in bad faith? Like, they just don't have the tools or the resources or whatever, because they are violating the letter of whatever law in that situation.
You know what would be really awesome? And I don't know how to organize this, but it would be so cool to have, like, a collective of people where sites like Bill's Car Garage or whatever, you know, like small mom and pop sites that just wouldn't have the money to do this correctly, get, like, kind of collected into a list, and then a collective of people would then go through this list and then offer them, hey, we'll do your, we'll, like, your site's inaccessible, we'd like to help you out with this, and then apply the few hours of work or whatever to bring it up to par. And just, like, on a volunteer basis, the list will be monumental. It will be absolutely massive, and this will absolutely be a Sisyphean task. But it's still worth doing, and it still improves things. And it's not, like, I would say most low-hanging fruit, like font contrast, font size, alt tags on images, setting your tables correctly, using headings correctly, those sorts of things can be done pretty easily and are easy to identify. And training people to do them isn't, it's not like advanced computing or anything, but something like that would be really cool.
I think it is well motivated on your part, well intentioned, and impossible. I think what really has to happen, because the thing is, Bill's Car Service probably built their site on Wix or Squarespace, and so and a lot of these tools are trying really hard to make accessible features.
Yeah.
And I think that's where the lion's share of the work is going to be done, ultimately. Like, encourage these people to use these tools, which feels like a dirty advice, actually. Like, there was a time where I would never tell somebody to, like, oh, you're going to have a better time setting your site up on Wix. Like, that was not advice I would ever give.
Shout out to Webflow, EJ Mason and Ruben Nick, episode 63.
Webflow is another good one, yeah.
Webflow, they put accessibility as a first-class citizen.
They have accessibility at a high profile.
We're not sponsored by them, but they were on the show before, and I think that what they're doing is really cool. So,
But all of these tools, I think, have improved it in great strides over the last 5 years.
Yeah.
And so maybe there's a secondary gift nice list there that, like, all of these platforms have done a lot to make themselves better, make themselves more accessible. And those are the trenches where a lot of those battles are going to ultimately be won.
Yeah. And
there's always going to be a few folks out there with just trash websites.
If you just need, like, you know, basically like a business card website, or, you know, your, what do we call that one? The KISS or the
PAM
phone address and menu, right? Yep. PAM. KISS PAM.
KISS PAM. With consent.
Right. If all you need is a phone address and menu or the equivalent for whatever your business is, those sorts of sites or services are fine. And no one's going to think less of you for using them. It's just, like, you know, get your content up there. Put out your shingle.
I've got one more for my nice list, but okay. Do you have anything else you want to throw out first?
I legit, we talked about it in the last episode, and I am going to sign up for the Google UX certification.
Your list ends where mine does, it sounds like.
I'm actually really excited about this. I haven't had a coursework in a while. I'm excited about the structured aspect. I asked a coworker of mine who is our UX person at my job. And she went to, I want to say, the Flatiron School.
Yeah.
Or one of those. One of those, like, or no, it was a General Assembly in DC, I think. And so she got her training there. But I don't know. I'm excited about this one. Just getting kind of the formal, like, structured education around it should be neat.
Yeah, I labeled mine a little more generically, and I was just going to say, I think this is going to be a good year for everybody for any kind of learning and training, opportunities to go out and take care of something new that you haven't tackled before.
Yeah.
One of those on that list is exorcism. We've, of course, talked about it before. Exorcism version 3 is now out. So you can go and check them out and check out the new tracks and the new approach to everything, the new point system, all of that. I am on a technology advisory group for the high school. And a couple times a year we get together and talk about, like, what is in the industry, what are some good resources that kids should look at. And I made it a point to call out that they ought to look at having their class go check out Exorcism and set up accounts and use that as part of the training, because then, like, if a kid doesn't want to do JavaScript, cool, let him pick something else. Like,
yeah,
there's a lot of parity across all of those tracks. Like, the same kind of example.
The Ruby track is great. I worked through a portion of the Ruby track on just for fun, and it's really great.
And the teacher doesn't necessarily have to be an expert in those tracks then, because they're very self-moderating. So you can set up, just say, your goal this week is to get 3 of those lessons done or something like that.
Right.
And the testing is built into it. You know, does it work? Well, the test is right there. so that's going to be huge, I think, for people.
We talked with Jeremy Walker from Exorcism back on episode 69 last year in August.
Yeah. But also, so I said at the start, Discord. The reason I wanted to shout that out, drunkenux.com/Discord. Aaron and I are going to hold to our word. We are both going to go through the Google UX certification. We invite all of you, any of you who want to do that with us, to check it out. We are going to set up a channel on our Discord server where we can all talk, share our experiences, ask questions, whatever, get insights. And so we're going to be open about that, and then we'll come back in 6 months, 8 months, depending on. I need to double check and see when the next start date is, or if we.
Oh, is just, it? Can we just jump in?
It's like pole positioned, kind of, I think. Like,
okay.
Like, it's self-guided, but they start it at, like, different times. And I don't know if you can just jump in at any given point. But we'll get an answer to that very quickly. But yeah, learning is sort of the next big, nice, good present. It's going to be a good year for that. The resources are getting so much better. I mean, I liked Exorcism before, but with version 3 and, like, then now you can do everything in browser. You don't even have to pull it down locally and do it. Like,
oh, nice.
It's super cool.
All right. I'll have to go back and check that out again. It's been a while.
So think about what your naughty and nice list is. Well, who's getting presents and who's getting coal? What are you looking forward to? What are you dreading for 2022? I think I said 2021 earlier, and it's been that year. It's 2020. Here's the thing, Aaron. It's 2022. That means it gets to be 2020 all over again.
Electric Boogaloo.
2022. So, Aaron, one more surprise present I didn't warn you about or tell you about. But this one is not one I'm giving out. It's one that is being given out to everybody. This comes from our sponsor over at Tela. So Tela is a platform that lets you capture your screen camera. You can present slides. Then you can customize those videos with different backgrounds. You can change your layout, add other video clips into it. But what they've just done that is super cool is their Chrome browser plugin is now available for users.
Oh, cool.
Get in there. You can click on it. Now you have a lot more control over what you're capturing in your screen, in your editing. And it just gives you a lot more flexibility in the editing outside of just, you know, in the platform, in the browser. This is great for either like recording updates for teammates. You can generate videos for followers on your platform, do demonstrations for customers, all of this with just one single browser-based screen recorder that let you share your work and knowledge. What's super cool, if you go to their website, tela.com/ducks, you can sign up for a free account, check all this stuff out. I've been playing with it. I've been able to like make some cool little screen captures of stuff for some of our CMS users. Get my face up there because all of them love seeing my pretty beard in the afternoon, like it's luscious golden locks. But it really is like it's super easy to make a very nice looking video that has kind of a personal touch to it, as opposed to sort of a sterile screen capture with a video in the box, little in the corner, you know, the video corner box. So check that out. Run by their website at tela.com/ducks. That's tela.com/DUX.
So it's maybe a little bit corny, but I do also throw a big fat metaphorical gift to all of the guests that we've had on this year. I don't know the exact number, but I know that it's many. And it's been really awesome to talk to all of you and
10, 12, great, probably.
Something like that. It's like half the episodes.
Roughly half the episodes, probably.
Yeah. So I always appreciate the insights that we have of the people that come on the show, and we greatly appreciate your time.
So. Just wait. I've got a few names in the hat that are going to be coming out early in season 5. Just saying. And I'm excited. And if I'm excited, that means I'm excited. I'm not very, like, deep.
So, yeah. Thank you. It makes the show better, and we appreciate it.
And if you want to keep up with us, be sure to find us on Twitter or Facebook at /DrunkenUX, Instagram/DrunkenUXPodcast, or come join us on Discord at drunkenux.com/discord. If you're enjoying the site or the show and you want to help support us, you can go by drunkenux.com/support. Join our Patreon, be a backer. We'll send you some free stickers and coasters and things. Thank you on an episode, and give you some extended length episodes, interviews, and things like that. And with that, that's a wrap on season 4. Thanks for sticking with us all year. 26 episodes, 26 more coming next year.
I'm still amazed. The 4 seasons, man. It's just wild.
I'd say enjoy your break, but we're recording next week, buddy.
Wait, what?
Listen, if there's anything at all I can do to surprise you anymore, it's that I have to, like, wake you up at 3 a.m. to record with somebody who's over in Europe or something like that. So,
hold on, I'm getting really concerned now.
Oh, you should be. You should be very concerned, because I have not clued you in on every decision I have made. It's one of those problems where I've not done a very good job at keeping my personas close, but my users and my co-host closer. Happy Christmas. Merry
Happy
New
Christmas
Year.
Holidays.
We look forward to seeing you in 2022. Stay with us. Have happy holidays.
Be safe, everyone.